If you have your own story of being in a cult or a high control group, or if you've had an experience with manipulation or abuse of power you'd like to share, leave us a message on our hotline number at 513-900-2955.
Or shoot us an email at trustmepod@gmail.com.
As a heads up, this episode does contain some graphic descriptions of violence. So if you're not into that, skip this one.
Trust me.
Dude, you trust me.
Trust me. I'm like a smart person.
Yeah, I've never lied to you. I never have lied to you.
You think that one person has all the answers?
Don't!
Welcome to Trust Me, the podcast about cults, extreme belief, and the abuse of power from two sleepy Joes who've actually experienced it. I am Lola Blanc.
And I am Megan Elizabeth.
I don't know why we're sleepy Joes, guys. It's just because we're sleepy.
It's
sleepy
Monday.
Gals.
Yeah.
Today, our guest is Brian Haloida, forensic psychiatrist and expert on a variety of topics, including atypical group beliefs. That's our shit right there. Today, he's going to talk to us about the phenomenon commonly known as folie à deux, aka shared delusions. And we're going to discuss examples of cases of folie à deux, including the case that the movie Heavenly Creatures is based on, the difference between delusions and weird beliefs or cult mind control, and how these things are transmitted to others.
We also talk about whether people are responsible for their beliefs, whether shared delusions warrant the insanity plea in criminal cases, and more.
And more.
So much.
Hey,
more.
Megan.
Yeah. Yeah,
what
bitch.
What is the cultiest thing that happened to you this week?
Well, the cultiest thing that happened to me this week happened in my own mind and life. It's me being the cult. And that was just kind of me thinking about a conversation we have in this podcast with Brian about signs. You know, he kind of talked about how that can be a gateway drug. Oh, it's a sign. Oh, it's a sign. Oh, it's a sign. But I do believe in signs. So, you know, just kind of grappling with that with myself.
So you see a coincidence, say you're talking about a fucking lion and then a lion walks by.
Totally.
What does that make you think?
Well, I was kind of talking to you about this at one point where it doesn't make me think my purpose has something to do with lions. I don't think the sign ever is giving you directions. It might be leading you a little bit, but I think it's just a wink from the universe. You just kind of got really in the matrix for a second.
What is the difference between leading you a little bit and guiding you in a direction, though?
Well, in my mind, I was just thinking about how this one time I was trying to move and I couldn't figure out where to go. And I had like a few problems in my life that really needed fixing. And a bunch of my girlfriends were like, we're going to this restaurant tomorrow night. And they just kept saying the name of the restaurant over and over and over and over. And I was like, shut up about it. I've never heard about it. What is this? And then the next day I got a message from somebody being like, hey, we got your application on Craigslist. I didn't even remember applying. The house is right across from the restaurant my friends had been to the night before. You should come look at it. And I might have been like, I don't even remember sending that email. Like, I don't know what these people are talking about, but that might be a coincidence. And so I went there and it turned out to be the house that I moved into, and it turned out solving a lot of the problems that I had pretty effortlessly. So something like that.
Yeah. So naturally, the skeptical Lola side would say something along the lines of, well, we also know that bias is such that once you hear something or see something once, you're primed to then hear or see it more, to be more attuned to it when you see or hear it again, whereas you weren't noticing it before. So that can often feel like crazy coincidences when in reality you just weren't attuned to that thing. And then also, there are so many events occurring all the time in the universe.
Trillions.
That for them to not be, for there to not be coincidences would be even statistically more insane than for there to be.
Totally. Them. Can I really quickly tell you the weirdest one that's ever happened?
Yes.
Okay. I was on a hike with my friend and her husband. He is an engineer and a researcher, and he was telling us about how they were connecting computers to monkeys' brains. Okay? So monkeys' minds were, they were trying to get them to be able to control computers. And we started talking about just the interconnectedness of our minds and technology and energy and all of these things. And he's very Lola-esque, and him, his wife and I are
your
not.
Wife.
We're very into the universe and
my
such.
Wife.
So we had this, we had this very intense conversation. And, you know, I felt like a little bit like that buzzy feeling when you're really present. And I don't know, I just felt weird. And then when we got back to my house, I checked my email and IMDb had sent me all these emails meant for her, his wife. And he sat there for the rest of the night, just staring out the window, trying to fucking figure out how this happened. And by the end of the night, he was like, I still don't believe in it, but something matrix, like we hit the matrix today.
You know, can I
like,
posit I a theory based on a Twitter yes. thread I recently read? Okay.
Yes.
So we all think that the phones are listening to us, right? Because we talk about something to our friends and then it comes right. up immediately after.
Well, just really quick, this was in like 2008.
Oh, okay. That changes things. Okay.
Yeah, no phones.
Got
no
it.
Phones.
Got well, phones.
Yeah.
Just not these kinds of phones.
Yeah, I don't even think we like brought them on a hike. It wasn't, you know, you didn't have
well then my technological point is moot, Megan. So fuck
yes!
it. I won't say
signs
it.
Signs are real. But- signs are real.
But I will, just to finish that thought, we think they're listening to us, but apparently uh-huh. the what's actually happening is that when you are in the same space with someone else, everything they have ever searched is then like your phone picks up on their searches. So it's advertising to mm-hmm. everyone that you are physically near. So when some stuff comes up in conversation that one person has been doing, like that's apparently why that happens. Not just because the phones are listening to us. Mm-hmm. That's beside the point, though, because this was in 2008.
Hey, you know what? It's good to know, though.
yeah, I mean, look, I definitely err on the side of skepticism, as we all know. However, I'm open and I appreciate the perspective that, you know, it's not necessarily the universe being like, you must go this path.
Right.
But it maybe it's just like, yeah, like a little glitch, a little.
It's a little wink.
A wink.
The universe is flirting with us.
I still don't think it's that, but I'm open. I can't say for sure that it's not. That's science, baby.
Yeah. Woo! What's the coziest thing that happened to you?
Wait, I actually want to tell one story before I say that, which is
great.
That when I was 17, I had moved out to Los Angeles. Well, I had sort of lived in Burbank, but then we moved to Vegas and I moved back out by myself at 17. And I was going to a community college. And what I really wanted to do for a living at that point in my life was become an FBI profiler. But ooh. I also loved music. For those of you who don't know, I'm also I'm a filmmaker and actor, but I've been a singer-songwriter my whole life. And I can't believe our own podcast producer, Steve, did not know that until this week. That is crazy to me. Fuck you,
wild.
Steve. Anyway. I have this dream of being a musician, but I was like, well, that's probably like I should find a practical path. I want to be a, you know, forensic psychologist, FBI profiler, whatever. I was taking a criminal justice class at the local college that I was going to, and I applied to become like a police cadet, which is crazy in retrospect considering my feelings about the police now. But I was, because I was like, oh, like maybe I'll be a cadet and it'll be a good path for the FBI when I joined the FBI to become a profiler and like hunt down serial killers was the fantasy that I had.
I love that this is your practical plan.
Always been very practical.
Okay.
So I took the test to join the cadets or whatever, and it was the easiest fucking test in the world. I'm an A student. I get perfect grades. This test was so easy. I didn't hear back about whether I'd gotten in. I didn't hear back about what happened with the test. And I called them eventually and I was like, it's been weeks. Like, what happened? Did I get in? Did I not get in? And they were like, we can't find your paperwork anywhere.
The universe wanted you to be a singer, bitch. You know it's true.
And at the time, I took it as a sign. And I was like, I guess I have to pursue music. That's going to be what I have to do. I have to just go for the dream. And that is what I did. But it's funny because, like, it's not like I became Lady Gaga. Like, in retrospect, I'm like, damn, I wish I would have gone to, like, a real college that I could have gone to and gotten an education.
Really?
Yeah.
Because you've done huge things. You've written a song for Britney. You are, in your own right, a pop star. Like, you need to chill. You're wrong.
I do have new music coming out, but it's truly not, like, I don't see that as... You know, if I were to pick my life's calling, I don't think it would be that, which would, if you told me that 10 years ago, I would have been like, fuck you. Yes, it is. I'm going to be a pop star, you know, so mm-hmm. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But on the bright side, it definitely ensured that I never became a police officer. So that's good.
Yes, because, yeah, that is good. Yep. You have very clear feelings about that. Mm-hmm.
would not have suited me. And yeah. anyway, I don't especially see that as a sign from the universe at this point in time, but that is how I took it then, and that is how some people
take okay.
it.
Well, that's okay. I'll hold it in my heart as a sign.
Thank you.
Give it the respect it deserves.
You can be my magical thinker and do all my magical thinking for me.
Thank you. Thank you.
No,
done.
Look, I'm open. I don't know. We don't know everything. I don't know.
There she goes. She gets it.
Anyway, that was my story about that.
Well, what's the fucking cultiest thing that happened to you then? Come on. Hand it
over. Well, the cultiest thing was just learning about a story. It didn't happen recently. Well, it happened a few years ago, but it's not like it's in the news right now or anything. But Dannon,
so it's not 2008 level recent. Loser.
Our dear friend Dannon told me a story about a girl, a 21-year-old girl named Kaylee Muthart. I don't know how you say it. But Kaylee, when she was 21 in 2018, she was addicted to drugs. She did meth. And she was also very Christian and held these very strong religious beliefs. Kaylee had a psychotic episode while on the meth. And she thought that she was hearing God telling her that in order to save the world, she had to gouge her own eyes out. And she did. She apparently ripped her own eyes out with her own fucking fingers and then squeezed her eyeballs in her hands. Mm. And I didn't read too much into it because Dannon, this is coming from Dannon now, but she said that she was like, why do I have to do this, God? Why do I have to do this? And God was like, you just got to do it to save the world. And so she did. And now she has no eyes. She's sober.
Well, she has them. They're just squished.
Do you think that they saved them?
I don't know.
I save Rambo's teeth after they come out, so who knows? Maybe it's like that. Oh, this is not funny. Oh, my God.
No, it's not.
It's so offensive. I'm so sorry, everyone.
Me too, for sure.
I'm
a former drug addict. I can say these things.
It's just fascinating. And it really pertains to this episode, I feel like, because the difference between delusions and crazy beliefs that are coming from a cult leader, like that line is really interesting because often there's overlap in what people think is reality is. But in this case, it was hallucinations induced by meth. And so the conclusion here is please don't do meth, kids.
No. Especially if you have strong beliefs in your head that lean towards a vengeful God.
Yeah, no. Meth and God, bad combo. Bad combo.
Not good.
But also, we've said on this podcast before to do drugs, and what we mean is, to clarify, do mushrooms.
Psychedelics.
Do psychedelics. Do not do meth. Do you think someone's listening to this podcast and they're like, I was going to do meth, but now I won't?
I mean, maybe. That story is like fucked up. It's inside of me now. I will never not have it. So thank you for that.
You are so welcome. And thank you to Dannon. Shout out to Dannon for alerting me to this. Anyway.
Damn, Dannon, thanks.
Well, shall we get into talking to Brian Haloida now?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, great. Here we go. Welcome, Brian Haloida, to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm very excited about this one. You study things that are very interesting to me. Can you tell us a little bit about your academic background and what your expertise is in?
Sure. I'm a forensic psychiatrist. I went to medical school, then I did residency in psychiatry, and then I did additional training in forensic psychiatry. And what that means is that I do evaluations for attorneys or the courts whenever there's a psychiatric issue and a legal question or an illegal case. So like common things that you may have heard of in the past are things like competency to stand trial. What that would be is an assessment of whether or not a person is capable of going to court or if they have a mental illness that prevents them from being able to understand their criminal charges or what's going on in court, or if their mental illness affects their ability to work with their attorney.
Right. I feel like a lot of people, a surprising number of people, don't know that there's a difference between psychology and psychiatry. Can you just clarify that distinction, please?
Sure. So at the basic level, psychiatry is a medical field. So if you're a psychiatrist, you've gone to medical school, you've done rotations in the different areas of medicine, and you've decided to work with patients with mental disorders or mental illness. Psychology, in many ways, is a much broader field because there are different areas of psychology and not all of them involve clinical work. So a lot of psychologists, some get master's degrees, some get PhDs, and they decide to do clinical work. So seeing patients and doing therapy with patients. But a lot of psychologists do research or do other things that are not patient care related.
But psychiatrists give us the pills, which is what, you know. Matters. Just
that,
kidding.
That is one of the big distinctions. Yes, yeah. we do medication management. So I work in a jail. That's my primary clinical setting. Whoa. So I work in a jail in the Bay Area. And in that role, this may be somewhat of a tangent, but a jail is a very interesting place to work as a psychiatrist because you basically have every type of psychiatry under the sun in one building. So you've got folks coming in off the streets who are intoxicated or have a mental illness and have been off their medications for months. Then you have people who just have general depression and anxiety, like milder issues that outside of the jail would be managed in an outpatient context. And then you've got crises happening around the jail and folks in crisis. So it's a very interesting place to work.
Yeah.
And now that's sort of separate from forensic psychiatry, but the work that we do in the jail overlaps a lot because we see folks who are undergoing forensic evaluations for things like competency or sanity.
Right. I actually had no idea that you work in a jail, and I feel like that adds just a total extra layer of interest of things that we can talk about. But for starters, I found you because I was Googling shared delusions, this idea that one person can sort of transmit their delusions to other people around them, which is called, at least I learned today that the DSM-5 sort of changed things, but I learned it is called folie à deux, or that is what people know it as. Or as Megan and I were saying earlier, the American way to say it is apparently folie à deux, according to some websites. But folie à deux, it's F-O-L-I-E-A-D-E-U-X.
It's French, you guys.
Can you just explain what this is and why the definition has sort of changed a little bit?
Yes. So folie à deux refers to what in English we call a shared psychotic disorder. And it typically refers to delusional thought content being transmitted or shared between two individuals. And a delusion is a belief that is fixed, meaning you can't convince somebody that it's false with evidence. The person will come up with other reasons as to why you're wrong and this belief is correct. So it's fixed, it's false, meaning it's not based in reality and there's no evidence to support it. And so in very rare cases, an individual with a delusion, usually somebody in a position of authority or somebody who's in a relationship in which they are the dominant individual somehow, will share these delusional beliefs with somebody else. And then that other person will begin to believe the same things.
That has to happen on smaller scales in like every family system, right? Is that just...
Well, delusions are an interesting thing. We don't fully understand the neurobiology as to how they form or as to whether or not, you know, we don't fully understand the processes that result in delusional belief. Mm-hmm. It's a complicated phenomenon. And so the idea that delusions can be transmitted between people is particularly fascinating.
Yeah.
But that process is likely more consistent with probably what you've talked about on this podcast before, where belief is transmitted within cultural groups. So whether that's like a cult, a religious sect, or even amongst like political dissident groups or political extremist groups, beliefs can be shared and transmitted. And I think what you often find, similar to how in folie à deux, there's a dominant individual in the relationship, you get a similar sort of dynamic in other groups, like in cults and in things like that, where there's a dominant charismatic figure who is the one promulgating the belief system and convincing other people of those beliefs. even though those may right. not be categorized as delusions.
Got it.
Yeah, I want to ask more about that particular piece in a second, but just for our audience, so the case that I always think of is the Parker Hume murder case in Christchurch, which the movie Heavenly Creatures was based on. Megan, do either of you know about
Kate
this?
Kate Winslet, terrifying. Wasn't she in it? She's like young yeah. Kate Winslet going full in. Yeah.
I'm just going to like go over the like what happened in that story. So basically these two young girls, they met at, you know, their Australian boarding school, whatever, and became obsessed with each other. And they started to basically create this world and create this sort of fantasy idea of like a fourth dimension where they could go. And that's, or it was like their version of heaven. And it resulted eventually when one of them was going to move away. And so they weren't going to be able to be together anymore. They decided that what had to be done was murder one of their mothers. So together they murdered one of their moms. And it's crazy. They only went to jail for like 5 years because they were young girls. They were, I want to say like 12 or something, kind of like that Slender Man
yeah,
case.
Yeah,
I was just going to say it sounded like the Slender Man
yeah. exactly like it. But there's like one main girl who's like, Slender Man told me that this is what we need to do. Mm-hmm, or like, mm-hmm. my mom is evil, we need to. And then the other person's like, yeah, that's kind of.
Yeah. And Heavenly Creatures, that's sort of how it's portrayed too. Like Kate Winslet is the one, she's the dominant one. But I don't know to what extent that's actually true or if they were just feeding off each other or whatever. But it's so fascinating to me. Brian, do you have any like examples or stories that you've seen in your work of this thing actually happening?
Yes. One example. It's a very rare condition, but I saw an example clinically during my training. So I don't know how much you guys know about the process of hospitalizing somebody psychiatrically in this country, but
nothing.
Okay, so in California, which is where I trained, people are placed on what's called a 5150 hold. And so usually that's done by like a social worker if the patient is brought into the emergency room, or it can be done by the police out in the community in the field, and then the police will bring the person in already on a hold to the emergency room. So a 5150 lasts 72 hours. And within those 72 hours, the person has to be evaluated by a psychiatrist. And then there's a determination as to whether or not the person needs to remain on the hold or if they can drop the hold. If somebody remains on the hold and they get brought into a psychiatric hospital involuntarily, then that hold can be extended on what's called a 5250, which is a 14-day hold.
Does it just keep going up to 5350, 54, 50,
no, there's a 5270, which is a month-long commitment.
Okay.
But it kind of ends after that point, although there are other mechanisms to keep people hospitalized. But if somebody gets put on this 14-day hold, then to protect patients' rights, there are a lot of safeguards put in place. So the patient can argue that they don't need to be on a hold and that they should be allowed to be released. And then under those conditions, a judge will come in and two attorneys, one for the psychiatrist and one for the patient. And each side will present their case as to why the person remain hospitalized.
Okay.
Now, this was a fascinating case. It wasn't actually my patient, but I was allowed to come witness this legal proceeding. Just in broad terms. So the case was of this elderly woman. She must have been in her early 60s. She was picked up because she was wandering around in an affluent area, knocking on people's doors saying, this is my home, you need to leave.
Whoa.
As you can imagine, didn't go down well.
Yeah.
So she gets picked up by the police, brought to the psychiatric hospital. She had numerous delusions. She believed, one, that she was rich and lived in this really wealthy neighborhood. So she believed that. She believed, I think, that she was married to a famous movie star, but that she had like shortened his legs by 2 feet. So he was like much shorter than he was supposed to be.
Whoa.
So it's fascinating. So we're at this hearing. She's got her attorneys. The psychiatrist is theirs. Psychiatrist is explaining to the judge why they think the patient needs to stay in the hospital. The patient doesn't say much during the hearing. Usually their attorney speaks and the judge just asks a few questions of the patient. But the interesting part is that this patient's daughter came. And their patient's daughter, she was sort of smirking and chuckling throughout this whole hearing as she sat there. And then At one point towards the end of it, the daughter started speaking, and she said that her mother indeed was married to a famous Hollywood actor and that she had shrunk him down to 3 feet in size.
Wow.
But I think, anyway, it doesn't really matter how it ended, but that was my first exposure to someone.
Wow.
Openly supporting the delusional beliefs of somebody else and having like taken on those delusional beliefs.
It's kind of like Munchausen-y somehow.
I mean, it's different. It's different from that.
But like, it's, I don't know. It's like their psyches becoming, I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know.
They're sort of, they're.
He's like, no, Megan.
No, it's not actually.
Nothing well, like that. I mean,
you could draw some patients with Munchausen's become so like used to it, I think, that it becomes like a Stockholm thing.
Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
They sort of adopt the role that they have been forced into.
Exactly.
Right. We're talking about Munchausen's by proxy, I think is
yes,
what.
Yes.
Yeah.
I just remember watching Mommy Dearest and she's like, I knew I could walk, but like, I also believed that I must not be supposed to. It's about
Mommy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mommy Dead and Dearest.
Okay, Mommy Dead and Dearest. You have to watch it. Anyway.
Well, it's also like sharp objects. That's another case of Munchausen's by proxy. Mm-hmm. But it's delusional. It's different because in this case, we're talking about belief formation and how people accept or reject untruthful beliefs that they are surrounded by. But it is fascinating that somebody can take it on that extremely to where they believe absolutely incredible things, like in this case.
You bring up a great point that I want to know more about, which is how do people come to believe these things? And also, what is the difference between a delusion and just like a weird belief?
Yeah. So, you know, like I mentioned, it's not fully elucidated how people take on beliefs or how beliefs form in general. There are a lot of models or theoretical models in cognitive psychology as to how beliefs form in general. In particular, how people might take on atypical beliefs. And there has been one proposed model for how people form beliefs or atypical beliefs, which is called the two deficit model, which involves a person having what is described as an anomalous experience. So that could be something that for whatever reason is particularly salient or important to that person, whether it's like they see something that is particularly striking to them, or they have a physical body sensation that they take on to have some sort of special meaning. So then along with that, there is a cognitive misinterpretation of that experience. So for example, in the case of like somebody is looking up at the night sky and they have this anomalous experience, some sort of visual distortion, or they see something like a flash or something like that. And then a cognitive misinterpretation of that would be, oh, that's like a UFO. And so then the person sort of holds on to this belief and maybe they look up more information about that and then they become convinced that what they saw was a UFO. So that's an example of one type of belief model of belief formation.
So it's like having an emotionally charged experience of some kind that you then connect to an idea that's happened simultaneously
And certain people may be prone to taking on sort of atypical beliefs or interpreting things in a certain way. So people who are prone to sort of what we call paranoid ideation or persecutory thoughts. There's a personality disorder called schizotypal personality disorder. And these folks tend to have very magical thinking, it's called. So they'll connect certain experiences in their lives, or they'll connect certain ideas in ways that are not totally delusional, like they don't have a schizophrenia or something like that, but it's they're able to connect things in a and relate them to themselves in ways that most people do not. Mm-hmm. So they may give more importance to events or information that they receive and connect it to their own personal life in a way that somebody else might just accept that and move on.
Yeah, I remember this guy that somehow was friends with my family. I feel like he babysat me a couple times when I was a kid. And he would just constantly think that everything was a sign and everything was connected. He'd see a rainbow on a billboard and he saw a rainbow that week. And he was like, that means that the Lord is blah, blah, blah. Like, it was just, it was so extreme. And I hated it as a kid. I was like, what is wrong with you? That's just a fucking random coincidence. But sounds like he would probably be in that category of someone who just like is doing that more than the average person, I guess.
Yeah. And there's this concept in psychiatry that we refer to as ideas of reference, where people sort of assume that things that are happening around them are personally relevant, or there's a message. They see something on TV and they somehow interpret that as like a personal message. And those sorts of beliefs can reach like a delusional level where it's like clearly not the case and their beliefs are false. Like right. Thinking that the television's talking to them or the radio's talking to them, that would be like a delusional level of that sort of belief.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because I feel like a lot of cultish groups are sort of mimicking delusions in the way that they perceive the world. Like, and I'm guessing most of those members, I mean, I know for a fact, we've interviewed many of them, most of those members are not actually people who have personality disorders, at least not those personality disorders. You know, it's a lot of drawing connections and seeing things as signs and God intends this because I saw this, you know. I mean, I guess that is really the crux of why I wanted to have you on here, because it is like they are taking on these delusions, even though they are ostensibly like psychologically healthy people.
Yeah. And that's where my initial interest in cults came up, was sort of how, at least in the courts, how are these beliefs viewed? So is somebody who is acting on the basis of a cult belief, like if they kill somebody or they assault somebody, if they do something criminal on the basis of their cult beliefs, are they able to say that they were not guilty by reason of insanity? Which, you know, is sort of a proxy as to whether or not the courts view these types of beliefs as delusional. And it turns out that, so I did a review of cases related to cults and these sort of beliefs. And in a lot of cases, courts reject that claim outright. And it all comes down to who's making the decision. So if it's a jury, I mean, the question is, can you convince a jury that the person's beliefs were somehow pathological and that they were experiencing these beliefs only because of the cult? And so they were ill in some way at the time they committed a crime.
Right. Yeah, that is, I mean, that's an area of particular interest to me. It's not considered a legitimate thing to be under the undue influence of somebody else's will. And it's honestly surprising to me that we think of Charles Manson as the evil one in that case, because I feel like so much of the time it is the followers who commit the crime who we want to punish and who we believe are acting out of their own volition. And I mean, and of course, look, when you commit a crime, like there should be consequences for committing a crime. But I think like we also have to recognize that, to use the colloquial term, brainwashing is a legitimate thing that happens.
Yeah. So it's interesting. When I initially published a paper about cult beliefs, the paper specifically looked at cases of cult members who had committed murder. Mm. And then the question of insanity arose at some point during their proceedings. And in none of the cases was the person found not guilty by reason of insanity. But after that paper was published, somebody reached out to me about a case. And it wasn't a case of murder. It was actually a conspiracy to commit murder case of a couple individuals who were in a cult-like organization. And in that case, one person actually was found not guilty by reason of insanity. And he was a member. He wasn't the charismatic leader of the group. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think courts generally like to have a psychiatric diagnosis and have that diagnosis to explain a person's behavior and explain how the person meets the legal criteria for insanity. But some have argued that, you know, there should be a more dimensional approach, meaning let's look at what the person's beliefs were and whether or not they fall into a specific psychiatric diagnosis. Let's talk about how those beliefs affected their behavior and may have motivated the criminal act. But, you know, determinations of insanity are yes or no. So it's the clearer a message a jury receives, you know, oftentimes that has the most sway, you know, whatever makes the most sense. So.
Right. Well, first of all, the DSM is an evolving like group of definitions, right? Like, is there anything in there that addresses like coercive control or being, you know, under undue influence of someone else?
So there was a brief mention in DSM-5 related to that very thing, but it doesn't come under a psychotic disorder diagnosis, meaning things like schizophrenia or delusional disorder. They have this section. So if you've heard of dissociative disorders, those are things like dissociative fugue. So the classic example is somebody who like wakes up in a different city or comes back to their normal self in a different city and doesn't know how they got there and doesn't know what happened in the intervening time. That's, we call that a dissociative fugue. There's also dissociative identity disorder, what used to be called multiple personality disorder, which is a highly controversial topic.
I was going to say,
in general,
yeah.
But
yeah.
So there's this chapter on dissociative disorders. And then in each chapter in the DSM, there's sort of this category at the end for things that don't quite fit with the other diagnoses. And under DSM-5, those are called the other specified disorders. So all that is just a prologue to say that there is an other specified dissociative disorder. And in the text of that, they write about there's this diagnosis of identity disturbance due to prolonged and intense coercive persuasion. That's the language of the diagnosis. And there's a brief description, which is, individuals who have been subjected to intense coercive persuasion, for example, brainwashing, thought reform, indoctrination while captive, torture, long-term imprisonment, recruitment by sects or cults or by terror organizations, may present with prolonged changes in or conscious questioning of their identity. So sort of an interesting, it addresses what you're talking about, but the curious thing is that it is focused on a person's sense of identity, which is a much more elusive concept than like somebody's beliefs and whether or not they're delusional or sort of pseudo delusional.
Right. Because if you believe that in order to like save the world, you are being told by God through your leader that you have to commit this crime, you know, that is, it's, it might not be about your identity specifically, but that I, to me, that's a pretty extenuating belief. I mean, and ultimately, like the question that it comes down to is like intent versus impact. If the impact is that somebody was harmed or murdered, obviously like that matters, but I don't think that intent should not be a part of the equation at all, personally.
You don't think
that I don't think intent should be ignored.
Right.
If somebody believes that what they're doing is actually a good thing.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And you see those in, you see that issue in insanity cases where, you know, somebody with a primary psychotic disorder like schizophrenia believes that unless they do this act, Satan is going to kill their children or something like that. So like the Andrea Yates case, drowned her children. She had a belief that, I think it was similar to that, that unless she did that, Satan was going to take her children or something like that.
Right.
And yeah, people can believe similar things on the basis of their involvement with like cults. And I think it's just more difficult to prove in court that those beliefs, this is going to sound funny, but it's more difficult to prove that like cult beliefs or other sort of group beliefs weren't voluntary. And I put voluntary in quotes because I don't really believe that what anybody believes is all that voluntary. Like,
right.
People are predisposed to believe certain things and they don't really have much control over what they end up believing. It's just how their brain works. That's
right.
Often, you know,
right.
That's one way to look at it. But I think courts in general have viewed people's involvement in religious groups or cults or whatever as voluntary behavior. And so anything that stems from that is sort of like, well, you chose to do this. And it'd be that it's sort of similar to like general religious belief, like people who make decisions on the basis of their religious beliefs, even from mainstream religions, like that's considered, you know, voluntary. And you're not, there have even been some cases, there was a case that went to the Supreme Court in 1944. There was a Supreme Court case called the United States v. Ballard, and this involved a cult called the I Am movement, and they had been convicted for defrauding people by claiming to have supernatural powers to cure incurable diseases. So this group was going around taking people's money and claiming to cure them by supernatural means. So this made its way all up to the Supreme Court, and the court said in their opinion that the question of whether the claims about the religious experiences were valid should never have even been given to the jury. And the quotation from their opinion is that freedom of religious belief embraces the right to maintain theories of life and of death and of the hereafter, which are rank heresy to followers of the Orthodox faiths. So the idea there is that people have the right to believe whatever sort of religious beliefs they want. And that's not really something to be judged or questioned in a court of law. And what comes from that is that if you don't question the religious beliefs, then whatever behavior comes from that was the person's choice. And it was totally volitional.
Right.
But, you know, I think there's more gray area there than...
Well, right, because that just allows absolutely no room for the process of indoctrination or manipulation that so often happens when somebody has complete control over others' lives.
Yeah, I was reading about the toolbox killers. I don't know, when I looked up what we're talking about today, that's what kept coming up for me. It was these two dudes in the 70s who murdered five girls together.
What were their shared delusions about, Megan? Do you remember?
Well, they're... shared delusions were that killing teenage girls was fine. And they wanted.
That sounds more strictly psychopathic to me than.
Yeah.
Well, it was one guy who was like leading it, is why this came.
Oh.
Because he was like, the other guy was like, he was more in charge. I tried to like let them go and he wouldn't let me. And we were in prison together and I got indoctrinated by him and blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, I kept reading these articles and one of them was just kept talking about how they shared hallucinations and I couldn't wrap my mind around it. But that makes sense that it's just not.
Right. It's just people mixing those words up, basically.
Yeah. But when you like are in a writer's room, sometimes you'll come up with the craziest fucking idea and somebody else has thought of it, thinks of it at the exact same time. And you're just like, what the fuck was that? I don't know. Anyway.
There are some things we cannot explain.
Yeah.
I just like trying to delineate where the difference is between folie à deux and, you know, just like shared group beliefs that are weird. Is it that like in a shared delusion or in folie à deux, it just like sort of organically becomes contagious? And in a cult, it's like willfully given to the other people? Yeah.
So again, this is such a murky area and it's something that I still write about because it's such a gray area, but let me think of a sort of systematic way that one could try to think about this, to try to delineate between the two. Mm-hmm. I guess I would say in folie à deux, one of the individuals at least, and then, you know, by extension, the second one develops a delusional disorder. So they have, you know, what meets criteria for a delusion. Now, part of the diagnosis of a delusion is that the belief is not accepted by the individual's cultural group or religious group. That's an exclusionary criterion for it. Mm-hmm. So like the belief, to some extent, at least, has to be idiosyncratic for that person.
Right. We can't just go to some island in the middle of nowhere where they believe something different and be like, you're delusional.
Right. And you can't call whatever percentage of the population of the United States that believes in QAnon. You can't say, oh, you're all delusional. Because for it to be a delusion, there can't really be like a community that...
Really?
A group of followers that adheres to this belief. And that's one reason why it's kind of hard to say that individuals who are in a cult all have like a mass shared delusional disorder. Some people have put forth that idea, but the very definition of delusion, like it's got to be somewhat idiosyncratic to that individual. So when looking at folks who have delusions, there are varying levels of different elements of belief that we can look at. So I'm referring to things like the degree to which a person is preoccupied with that belief. So how often is the belief coming to them? How much sort of cognitive space does it take up for them in a given day? So you can talk about levels of preoccupation, levels of conviction. So as I mentioned before, a person with a delusion cannot have their belief shaken. Like they believe in this regardless of any evidence presented to them. Whereas some folks in cults or some people who believe conspiracy theories, they may openly say they're not 100% on board with the beliefs, even if they report that they generally believe it. There is a concept of how self-referential the belief is. So some have argued that delusions will be more self-referential, like the belief affects them more personally than perhaps, say, belief in QAnon. Like belief in QAnon may mean that somebody believes things about the government, people in the government, people in Hollywood. They may believe all these things, but it doesn't necessarily directly impact their life so much. Mm-hmm. Whereas a delusion typically is like very closely tied to the person's life.
Right.
So there are these other facets of the belief that we can look at to try to distinguish between a delusion. But again, even with non-delusional beliefs, some of these factors can be quite strong.
Well, let's talk about cult leaders for a second, moving beyond the members, because one thing that comes up for us a lot and that we often wonder about is which cult leaders are, you know, knowingly conning people and which ones are themselves experiencing delusions. And if they are experiencing delusions and then transmitting their genuine delusions onto all of their followers, does that not qualify as a shared delusion?
Right. And in my review of cases of cult murder, some of the cult leaders actually received psychotic diagnoses. So I don't know if you guys have covered the Michael Ryan cults in Nebraska.
No, but was his son murdered somebody at the time, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So that was an interesting case because Michael Ryan, the leader of the cult, was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. So he believed all sorts of strange things. He said that Yahweh was giving him directions to build a base camp, to like stockpile weapons and cattle and construction equipment and all this stuff. And ultimately, he killed two of his followers, I believe, in a pretty brutal manner. One of them, he like sodomized with a shovel.
And one of them was 5 years old.
Yeah, they killed a five-year-old. And then his 15-year-old son, Dennis Ryan, stomped on the chest of one of them until they died. So, like, super brutal stuff.
God.
But, yeah, the cult leader was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia, but it didn't sway the jury, and he wasn't found insane. And then the son also put forth a not guilty by reason of insanity plea, and somebody diagnosed him with shared psychotic disorder, or folie à deux. But again, it didn't convince anybody, and he was convicted.
My understanding is that the insanity plea doesn't like almost never works. What is your experience of that or knowledge of that?
It is extremely rare. Different figures have been thrown out for how often it's used and how often it's successful, but it is very rare.
I was just reading that you don't want to be.
You're sent to the hospital and sometimes indefinitely. Whereas if you go to prison, yeah, you just like serve your time and leave.
Exactly. Yeah. And yeah, it's scary people. Anyway.
Yep.
Well, unless you were going to go for life or for death.
Right. Then you would.
In which case, yeah.
And then you would claim a delusional disorder. And then within a year of being in the hospital, your delusion would magically disappear. That's the way to fake it if you're going to fake it.
Noted.
Writing this down.
So as far as the insanity defense and its use goes, a recent study demonstrated, so this study doesn't talk about how often it's used, but I can tell you it's not commonly brought up. But when it is brought up, an expert will find a defendant insane in about 14% of their evaluations. So that's the expert's opinion. Now, when it's actually raised in court, approximately 26% of defendants are acquitted as not guilty by reason of insanity.
So 26% of 14%.
Yes. But that's 14% of evaluations who think that, yes, the person is insane. It's not right. That an attorney will have their defendant evaluated 14% of the time. It's probably less than that as far as even having somebody get evaluated for that.
Right.
It's different in every state because different states have different statutes and the standard for insanity differs in different states. So it just depends.
Yeah. Do you think that, by the way, we've been saying DSM a lot and I feel like there are probably a lot of people who don't actually know what that means. So do you want to just define DSM?
Yeah. The DSM is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. And so this is our our book that psychiatrists and psychologists and some social workers use to make psychiatric diagnoses. And so we're now in our fifth edition, which came out in 2013. And the book evolves with each iteration. Diagnoses will change somewhat. Sometimes diagnoses will be taken out entirely. So for example, the shared psychotic disorder, or folie à deux, was taken out of DSM-5. It's not even in DSM-5. But I had previously mentioned that each chapter has an other specified category, and there is an other specified diagnosis under the psychotic disorders for something that's similar to shared psychotic disorder called delusional symptoms in partner of individual with delusional disorder.
Right.
Which I actually think it's a bigger mouthful, and it's not as nice as the French folie à deux, so it doesn't sound as great. But I think it likely better captures what is actually going on in the situation, because you know, the person who takes on these beliefs, they might not have the same conviction as the primary individual with delusional disorder.
Right.
And what you find is that when you separate the two, the person who took on the beliefs tends to lose them over time. Like they don't typically develop like a full-blown delusional disorder where they then continue to believe that stuff. Like once they're separated from the dominant individual, oftentimes those beliefs will sort of go away, or they can be more easily managed. Whereas individuals with delusional disorder have like a legitimate psychotic disorder that requires treatment with medication for it to go away.
Right. The question of who has a disorder and who doesn't in terms of cult leaders is one that will just endlessly fascinate me. And I wish we could get evaluations for them all, because, you know, I mean, for some of them, like we were just saying this in the last episode, so sorry, listeners, if I'm repeating myself, but my former cult leader sometimes will admit that he was conning people and sometimes won't. And sometimes it seems like he really does have these delusions of grandeur. And it's kind of, it can be pretty hard to tell whether he actually has delusions or not, you know?
Yeah. And it's hard. I mean, forensic psychiatrists don't have a crystal ball either. So
yeah,
this is an area where, you know, somebody who's not informed about the background of the individual and doesn't have the full history may label somebody as psychotic or having like a major mental illness when they don't really. So just as an example of that, there was a paper published about the forensic evaluation of sovereign citizen folks. And for those who don't know, sovereign citizens are people who hold, I would say, atypical political beliefs. They believe that the U.S. runs under maritime law, that when each person is born, the birth certificate that is given in all capital letters represents like the establishment of a corporation in that person's name, that the U.S. government establishes a trust for that person. Lots of strange beliefs that sound, frankly, delusional, right? But it is a well-subscribed set of beliefs that groups in certain states have. It's often associated with like militia and white supremacy type stuff. But there was a paper published about the forensic evaluation of these people, and the author wrote how in reviewing cases of sovereign citizens that he had evaluated, he had found one of the people incompetent to stand trial on the basis of a delusional disorder. And then he said, looking back on it, that was probably a mistake, and the person's beliefs were likely just consistent with sovereign citizen beliefs. I just wasn't aware of it at the time. And so he made that opinion, perhaps incorrectly, looking back on it.
Wow, interesting. Well, with the advent of the internet, I mean, it just seems like it's so easy now to transmit your delusions to other people. You know?
Yes.
And then if you transmit it to enough people, it's not a delusion anymore.
We don't know if the people who started QAnon were delusional or not.
Right. Our former QAnon believer that we had on our podcast firmly believes that that Q is just a sociopath who is like fucking with everyone.
I mean, it started on Reddit, right? Like,
yeah.
Talk about the source of a never ending source of psychopathy on the internet is Reddit. But I shouldn't say that. You can find a lot on Reddit. I'll just say that. But yeah, I mean, the internet has facilitated the spread of beliefs. It's facilitated the spread of fake news. It's facilitated the dissemination of emotionally charged videos containing clips that you don't know where they came from or how out of context they were taken. But if you string it together, there are going to be people out there who are susceptible to believing whatever you're putting out, because all of us, to some degree, are susceptible to believe things that we see and hear, especially if it resonates with our personal experience in some way. So, which is sort of relates to that two deficit model of belief formation that I mentioned previously.
Right. And which just reminds me again, I mean, we're not going around and choosing our beliefs. I wish that we could, because I would choose much kinder beliefs about myself if I could do that. Because the shit that I believe about myself is fucked up, man. It's like not nice.
Our minds are hopelessly subject to the influences that come at us. And yeah, I mean, we don't get to choose what we believe.
Yeah. I mean, like, we can choose to, I guess, maybe not, but even that, I'm like trying to choose to reprogram my beliefs, but it's still like, it's not just happening. Like, I have to go to CBT and like, you know.
Yeah. You are not responsible for the fact that you are motivated to do that, or that you have the motivation to change those beliefs. That is not something you controlled.
Right.
You did not control the preconditions that led you to getting to a point where you were contemplating change.
100%. Because free will doesn't exist. Okay.
I didn't say it.
I just had one more thought, which is just a bit of a tangent. But I also want to just point out that American psychology, you know, the DSM is very different from, it's just American, the American standard, like the British, whatever it's called, the British Psychological Society, they have different definitions of things and everything is evolving. You're kind of giving me a sort
yeah.
of, so
like other folks use something called the International Classification of Diseases to make diagnoses. There's like pretty good overlap in most areas on those things. But certainly, I mean, there are different people in different camps about certain elements of psychopathology who, you know, have certain beliefs about disorders or diagnoses. And these things are evolving. But yeah, I guess I'll just say that about it.
Yeah. I only said that to, my only point with saying that is to say that a lot of this stuff, I mean, I think there's a lot of work to be done in getting to a place where we do have definitions that make sense. Does it even make sense to have labels to the extent that we do? And there's more recognition of what coercive control is in other places. And I think it's just all evolving, and hopefully we'll get much better.
Yeah. I mean, the DSM is not the end all be all of psychopathology. It's a manual that we use.
That'll be different next year, or, you know, in 4 years.
Yeah. I mean, there are changes with each edition. It's might not be as sweeping as some people imagine the changes to be. In some areas, there are significant changes that affect how diagnoses are made or how diagnoses may play out in the courtroom. That's certainly true. But I mean, there's so much research and data and opinion, expert opinion beyond what's in the DSM. So, I mean, I think that's why you had me on here, which is belief is something that we don't fully understand, like the basic science and the neurobiology of belief and how beliefs form. We don't fully understand that yet. And then when it comes to these shared beliefs amongst groups of people, you know, the definitions get blurry and things get really difficult. And we haven't talked about it yet, but there are sort of some ways that have been tried to describe these beliefs. So we've been talking a lot about what some call delusion-like beliefs, or DLBs. So these are like shared beliefs that, you know, to an outside observer may seem psychotic, you know, whether it's in a cult, whether it's in like the sovereign citizen movement, or whether it's in conspiracy theorists. Like, a lot of these types of beliefs could be called delusion-like beliefs because they sort of straddle the line between accepted within a subculture, but also seeming really pathological. So that's been one method to try to describe these. And then there's been another recent term called the extreme overvalued belief, which we don't need to get into that because the definition is fairly lengthy. And the reason they're called extreme is more based on the behavior that results from the belief than the actual belief itself. So there's sort of some internal confusion as to, like, what does it mean to have an an extreme belief. Like, so, but I think the delusion-like belief better captures what we're looking at, which is, you know, beliefs that appear totally bizarre from outside, but they may seem consistent amongst the group members.
And if there were a clear definition in the DSM that referred to not just as a footnote, but like a clear term for what happens when you are under coercive control, do you think that more people would be found not guilty when they commit crimes for their cult or whatever?
I don't know. Again, that mention of coercive control in the DSM now under that dissociative disorder category is strange, and I haven't seen it come up in any cases. I've never actually seen a dissociative disorder. Oh, I take it back. Never mind. Spoke too soon. I have seen that attempted to be used. But I don't know. I mean, definitions only get you so far. Like, the problem with definitions is they can be flexed and they can be bent. So it really requires like a deeper understanding of the literature on belief formation and on these groups and how beliefs get transmitted within these types of groups, I think, to make an argument that somebody should be found insane on the basis of their beliefs.
Right. Well, insane. I mean, that's a whole nother tangent we could go on. Cause I'm like, does it have to be insane or could it just be influenced, you know?
So oftentimes as a forensic psychiatrist, you'll be asked to evaluate somebody and they're not going for an insanity defense, but they're going for just get me a psychiatric evaluation and tell me if there are any mitigating factors in this case. Mm-hmm. So like help the attorney and help the court understand the person's vulnerabilities, if they were laboring under any sort of mental illness, or if not a mental illness, you know, something that doesn't fit as neatly into the DSM. Like, and in those cases, it might be more appropriate to talk about coercive control and things like that. Mm-hmm. And how that affected the person in the commission of a crime, if they've been accused of one.
How do people, do you want people to find you on social media or do you have?
I have a website. It's basically for like attorneys to contact me, but it has a submit page if like people want to submit questions or whatever.
Oh, cool. Where is that?
It's just my name at .com, BrianHaloida.com.
BrianHaloida.com.
Yeah.
Submit any questions. That was great.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Hopefully it's somewhat enlightening or educational.
So much.
Oh, totally. Yeah. All righty, Megan. So your question for today is not would you join this group, because what group would we be talking about? But your question is, do you think you've ever experienced like a light form of folie à deux where someone believed something or had some weird idea and then you kind of took that on?
So much, yes. Yeah.
Give me an example. Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm thinking, let me ask you the same. Do you have one?
The first one that comes to mind is, I feel like such a loser talking about this because I feel like I've talked about this relationship. Luckily, no one can tell the difference between which relationships I'm referring to in any episode. So,
isn't it great?
Yeah. But there is a relationship that I was in which my beliefs about myself changed dramatically over the course of the months that we were together. And he had like formed a conclusion about me that is not aligned with reality necessarily. But because he was so insistent on it, by the end of the relationship, I had taken that on into my identity. And I was like, oh, I don't think like this. I'm not a person who does this. I'm just a lowly other kind of person. And it was only like months afterward that I was like, what? That's ridiculous. What?
No.
What? Granted, it's not a delusion, but it is a false belief. It is a, you know, a change in my thoughts that happened due to someone else. I mean, look, I also participated in allowing myself to take on those thoughts, but you know, we're only so strong.
Yeah. We're only so strong. That's a really good one. I like that. I mean, I hate it for you, but
you're like, I like that for you. I like you.
Yeah. You keep that. That fits you well. I think mine is like in eighth grade, I became friends with this girl who was new to our school, and she was very, like she had a very outcast mentality, kind of in like a rebellious, cool way, but I became like best friends with her really quickly. And it was very like, everyone hates us. And I was like, everyone does hate us. And suddenly I just felt like everyone hated me.
Mm. Mm-hmm. That's a good, that I feel like that happens in friendships a lot where it's like, it's everyone's against us, or I don't know.
Yeah. Or sometimes it's like everyone loves us. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Oh, I could think of, yeah, actually it's, I mean, look, this is obviously the one of the topics that fascinates me most in life, where I'm like, someone thinking something and then influencing other people with that thought, regardless of its connection to reality. I just find that process to be incredibly fascinating.
It certainly is.
And I have nothing else to say about that.
I love that. Do you think that this episode is concluded in all of its beauty and exceptionalness?
Well, I was also thinking it's the end of the episode. It's a coincidence. The universe is leading us.
It's winking. Oh my God, you got a wink. You're so lucky. All right, guys. Well, thank you so much for listening. Remember to follow your gut. Watch out for red flags. And never, ever
trust me. Bye.